The reason we record these is that we put the recordings on our website in addition to post-session notes. So we may have some new people that joined us, and if you are interested in some of the other discussions, you might want to, you could go back and look at all our post-session notes. And the website is brownfieldstoolbox.org. It's actually brownfields-toolbox.org. And when you get to that site, you'll see PLC Corner. And there's a lot of good reference materials, and particularly the people who are new and may not have gone to the, this is actually session 9 of this tranche of PLC sessions. We're going to have another one on December 14th, and then we're going to start over again after the holidays. But we, during this cohort, we basically have gone through all the components of developing a sustainable job training program. So we started out with labor market assessments and recruitment and student services, and today we're going to be talking about curriculum. But before we start, we always do news from Washington. And Glo, any news today?
Actually, no, not a lot. Obviously, the 2017 RFP for the job training grants has not come out yet. I would just have to assume that with the recent election and whatever else is going on, that things have gotten a little behind. So I'm sure it's just been delayed and that they will probably update the due date accordingly, but it has not come out yet. We will be sure to let everyone know through the listserv and Mike through his distribution list for the PLC as soon as that RFP is released. But at, like I said, as of yet, it has not been released. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that HMTRI's partner, the Partnership for Environmental Technology Education, every year put on a two-week train the trainer program, which I'm sure several of you already know about. This year's is going to be June 5th through the 16th here in Davenport, where I'm from. This is a two-week training institute to prepare trainers to deliver 40-hour HAZWOPER, 24-hour industrial emergency response, DOT, and hazard awareness. It's a great program. They limit it to about 20 people. As of this morning, they have 10 to 12 applicants, so they still have spaces available. The due date for applications is February 28th. So if you're interested in that, Mike, maybe you can include that flyer in the post-session notes.
Will do.
And that Great. Was all from me.
Okay. And, of course, way on the calendar, this is next year, will be the annual Brownfields, the big Brownfields meeting, but that's not until December 5th of 2017. So it's every 18 months, and we just had one not too long ago. So that's also on the calendar. If anything comes up, we always put them in post-session notes. And I had mentioned earlier, go to brownfields-toolbox.org and go to PLC Notes, and we in PLC Corner, and we have all of the sessions. We're on 159 right now, but from 151 to 159 is the most recent, when you'll see the notes of what we've talked about in training, recruitment, placement, and, of course, today we're getting into curriculum. We're trying to go in the order that you would develop your program in terms of the importance of different things. And, of course, we've always said you want to work backwards because it's a job placement program and we're placing individuals. So you really have to – we started with labor market assessments and community assessments to find out what you're dealing with in your community. And then, of course, we'll work backwards. Well, we're all the way back to curriculum, and we're talking about what should we be training? And there are health and safety courses. There is environmental remediation courses. There's life skills courses. And we're going to talk about the types of training today, and we're going to talk about delivering that training, how you might schedule it, and about what training is covered by EPA and what isn't. And so those are some of the significant issues. We did have a question between the last PLC in today, and they were wondering about eligibility. If they were a grantee, could they resubmit this year? And basically, what we're doing is referring back to the RFP 2016, which probably won't change a lot. There may be some changes, but if you need a reference, you go back to that, and I'll include the website. It's on the EPA website, but I'll put the exact URL on the notes that you'll get on Friday. These are post-session notes of today's session, and you can go there. If you pretty much read through that, you're going to be right on. And, of course, a lot of these things take a lot of time to do, especially establishing partnerships. So you're going to want to look through that and use that as your guide. Of course, once the RFP is issued, it's crunch time, and you may not have enough time to do all the things we talked about in terms of having meeting with city council, maybe having some public getting onto the agenda on a public hearing, having some discussions with the community. So you really want to get onto that as soon as possible to make your responses proposal better than everyone else's. So the question I had is, what about eligibility? Of course, you have to be a nonprofit or a governmental entity. The kicker is, if you were awarded something in 2016, FY16, last year, you can't reapply this year. You also can only submit one application, so you can't submit five applications or whatever. And also, one thing that's subtle that's in that RFP, it says you really can only have one target area, except if you're covering a broad area, like a rural area or a very wide area that might include several towns. But for the most part, you want to zero in on a particular target area. And you can go back to the RFP if you want to and look that up specifically. And I'll point it out in the notes, the exact page, so you could look it up and see. I expect most people that are on the call are eligible. And we'll talk at a future date about some specifics in terms of writing your grant. We're not there yet in terms of the steps we're going through on these PLCs, but what you need to do in terms of getting ready to submit that grant. So let's talk about the curriculum. And one thing about curriculum, it really varies widely. It depends on your local regulatory environment, your local industrial activity, what's going on, even the employers that are in your area. And again, we're working backwards. We're finding out in the labor market assessment and the community assessment, which we talked about last time, we're finding out what are we dealing with in this community. And that's going to help us define our target area. We're going to find out if we've got a lot of demolition going on or deconstruction. We're going to find out if lead is indeed a problem. If it's a new community, probably isn't. If it's an older community before 87, it's could be a major problem. Do we have asbestos problems in there? Do we have underground storage tanks? So we want to get a good feel for what's in our community. And as we go across the United States, we've got huge variances. And you'll find that between grantees, you're going to see variances in what they're teaching. You could also, if you go to Brownfield's Toolbox, you can look at the grantees that are currently being funded, and usually they'll give a quick description of the courses that they're teaching. So that might give you some idea. The other thing about curriculum is it'll change from year to year sometimes. Particularly on new grantees, that first year they may get started, and they really didn't work closely enough with their employers. And once they got going, they started to bring their employers after the fact. And their employers said, well, you know, if you would teach these particular courses, and we'll talk about advisory committees. This is really important. They will tell you, gee, you know, if you put in a confined space certification in there, it would really help because you're teaching lead, but they need the confined space for the where they're going. Or you definitely, you know, we do have a need for runoff, or we have a specific issue with demolition and asbestos. So you really, and it may change from year to year. So that first year, you have to be ready to be flexible. We've had grantees who the first year they were going on one thing, but then again, the jobs those same jobs didn't appear the next year, so they had to tweak the program as they go along. I remember one of the grantees, Memphis Bioworks in particular, I'm not sure if they're on the line, but they indicated that one way to mitigate this issue of different people needing different things is to have this broad curriculum with a variety of skills and certifications that can get people in the door. You're going to do your labor market assessment, and you're going to have advisors who are employers, and they're going to be telling you what they're interested in. But if you give a little broader range of certs, and there's lots of those that are relevant to the community, it could be that they don't have exactly what the employer have, but they have those particular certs that get them in the door. And I remember early on when we were having hurricanes, in this particular New Orleans, anyone, of course, it's a mandatory course, anyone who had 1910-120, the HAZWOPR cert, they were looking for them to come down because they needed that cert. But the same could apply to other types of certifications. And these, when we talk about certifications, of course, as you look at the RFP, HAZWOPR 1910-120 is so important because you need it to go on a site that's got hazardous materials. And these, there's a lot of OSHA certs. Mostly you get your certs out of OSHA, some out of EPA. Most of the health and safety will come out of OSHA, 1910-120, confined space. I'll have a whole list of them in the post-session notes. There's probably about 12 of them that are relevant to the Environmental Workforce Development Job Training Program. There are FEMA certs. There's some DOT and even HUD certs. So there are, they're all relevant, and they're relevant to this program because you can't remediate if you're not protecting yourself. So they really are mandatory. So you need to, and the one thing about certifications, you have to be careful about them because some of them, like RRP, require, they're regulated and they require certified curriculum and certified instructors. Most of those OSHA certs have regulation attached to them. So you have to be careful when you're looking for a trainer. If you, some people train internally, and then some go out to consultants. And if you're going out to consultants, or you may be going to a college even, you have to be very careful that what they're teaching, one, does it require a certified trainer? Does it require a certified curriculum that needs to be approved? What is the specifics on that? And you have to make sure, because in the end, you're going to be the one that's, if they're not getting proper training and something happens, you're going to be the responsible party. So you really have to be very careful, particularly when you're, if there's a certification involved. A lot of them, particularly the awareness courses, don't require that. And you could teach it, or anyone familiar with that topic can teach it. Of course, you always want to have, and the instructors know this, they want to have goals and objectives and exactly what they're teaching, particularly the important ones when you're talking about things like HAZWOPR, exactly what that person's going to be taught to, and pre and post tests, so that if someone does get hurt in the act of remediating, you're going to have proof that he was taught it. This is what he was taught, that these were the tests he took, and so that he went through the training. Again, basically to indemnify yourself, and just a matter of good training practice. One word about trainers as you're approaching this RFP is you need to go out for bid if you're using consultants, and you need to get 3 bids. If you're using a partner, or if it's a leveraged contribution where you're not paying for it, no exchange of money, that's not an issue. But if you're going to be using a consultant, you need to have them on board if you're going to write them into the proposal. So, of course, we've always suggested what you can do now is go out on your RFP now and solicit certified instructors, particularly if you need them to be certified. Describe all the training and get your bids, and put a contingency depending that on you getting funding from EPA. That way you've done all the homework. They're on board. And you've got that contingency that if you don't get the grant, there's no problem. But if you get the grant, they're on board, and you can actually then write them in a proposal that this is the trainer you're going to be using, and this is his experience. Once you go too far into this grant and you've got a month left or a half month left, and all of a sudden you've got to demonstrate how you're going to train and who's going to be training and what is their experience, and you don't have anyone on board, you find yourself in a little difficult situation, because you can't, it's difficult to describe someone that you're going to be using when you really haven't gone through a vetting process to bring them on board. And of course, if you're an organization that's already training and they're on board, that's okay. You don't have to worry about that. But just from point of view of procurement, it's just a little word of caution that if you don't have a trainer and you're planning on using someone, get them on board before you write your grant with that contingency that you get funded. So when we talk about this, we've got, of course, this is mostly relevant to the brownfields related training and the health and safety training. The life skills training, it's also relevant, but often, as we talk about in different sessions, life skills are leverage training that you can get for free often, or as a from a partner. Let's talk a little bit about how much training do you deliver in one of these programs? And they as the course loads and the courses they teach vary all over the map. And the delivery of each of these grantees varies. They range anywhere from, say, 160 hours of training to 370 hours of training, which is quite a range. Some offer a few certs. Some offer as many as 19 certs. We have grantee providing 19 certifications. We have some providing 8 certifications, one just a few. So it really depends on that labor market assessment and how broad you want to make your program. And that really depends on your local situation. The way people train in terms of scheduling these courses also varies. We've got grantees who have intensive programs that go 6 weeks, 5 days a week, 8 to 5. They're usually, say, a couple hundred hours of training. They want to simulate the actual work environment, and they actually incorporate it into their training program. So it's just like going to work. So you're going to work. You can't miss work. You can't be late. You have to be punctual, and you can't miss a day. So they really want to get the student into the mode of training. Now, having said that, some programs are set up where people are trying to earn a living and trying to survive, and they can't do that. So they may go up as high, long as 16 weeks, and they may do evenings, and they may do several evenings a week, maybe Saturday, and they obviously can't simulate training, but are working conditions, but they what they do is demonstrate it's much harder to often to go to night classes and have the discipline to go, particularly in bad weather, and go on Saturday and have all your free time training. It certainly demonstrates persistence. And we've had people who have done both. They've tried concentrated training during the day. Some have decided they want to shift and try evening classes. So that's something, again, that's subjective. And when we talked about a couple weeks ago about community and labor market assessment, when you're determining your target audience, this is part of doing those assessments early. You've got to, who are you dealing with? Who are you going to be training? Is your target group basically unemployed and they're going to have time during the day? Do they have to travel long distances? And of course, we suggested that if you're choosing a target area, it's got to be convenient or on a bus line or something easy to get to your training facility. If that will determine to some extent what kind of training you do, it's kind of like a big jigsaw puzzle. If you've got people who are working part-time, they're underserved populations and they're just trying to survive with a job they have to do during the week, you may have to go to the evening classes. We also have special situations in that case where Alaska in particular. Zender in particular, they, of course, when you're talking about long distances, and they actually fly people to the training site, so they'll actually bring people hundreds of miles to come to the training site, and they'll put them up for a week or 2 weeks at a time and then fly them back. Or they might do a week at a time, fly them back, and then bring them back. That's kind of the extreme. But in rural areas, that may affect your training and how you schedule your training. And some may say, well, you're talking about minutia. When you talk about responding to this grant, I'm going into detail, but you need to go into detail. When you start doing your training plan, it's important that you describe exactly what you're going to do. Are you going to bring people into a central location? Where is your target audience in relationship to your training facility? How are people going to get there? Are they going to be taking the bus? There is no transportation? How are you going to get them there? So these are the details that'll make the point or two difference of being funded or not funded. If you've got those details into your plan, it's well thought out, you're going to be much better off. This grant is a little different than most grants. It's a cooperative agreement. And really, once you've laid it out, it's a matter of doing your program plan. You almost have to visualize the entire course through the program before you even start. Very untypical. Most grants are grants. They give them the money, and then they wing it as they go along. And you may have to make course corrections, but for the most part, the whole thing is laid out for you and well thought out as you go into this. So it's really important in terms of how you're going to schedule, what you're going to schedule, how many hours you're going to be training, what certs you're going to be training, who's going to be training, are they on board, what's the experience that these people have, are they reputable, are they set up for the entire schedule, when are you going to train? Now, because of your labor market assessment, you're going to probably find, depending on where you live, that the power hiring season may be from March through November, or that's when we're doing remediation. If you're in the north, it may be shorter. If you're in the south, it may be year-round. But you're going to have to schedule your classes, and you may have several classes, two or three, and here's another decision. Are you going to do two or three classes? Are you going to have larger classes or smaller classes, depending on what you teach? If you're teaching courses that require hands-on, and you're going to be doing fit up, you may have to have 20 or so in your class. You may be having some classes that are going on concurrently where you could have larger classes. But you've got to schedule it so their graduation is well enough in advance so that you could get them their applications in and have them on the job. So this is extremely important, particularly for new grantees. All of a sudden, they find out that they want to get going. They've graduated, and there's no jobs because the timing wasn't right. So those are all issues that you have to look at in terms of that scheduling. I want to talk a little bit about training facilities and about delivering, how you're going to deliver that training. Obviously, most people use textbooks, the old traditional approach. We have one program that I really like to talk about a lot is Florida State at Jacksonville, who I don't know if Kathleen is on the call, but they decided to approve the use of tablets, and it's proven to be very innovative and very interesting, and they gave everyone a tablet, and upon graduation, they kept the tablet, and they were able to take their entire curriculum, almost all of it, and get PDFs of it from different sources, and they were able to put reference materials on there, curriculum on there, and the tablets, of course, now that they use it under $100 or so, they really didn't even bother with insurance, gave everyone a tablet, assigned that to them. They really did it informally. They really didn't track it. In fact, after graduation, they wanted them to keep them because they were able to sign up on for email. That was a great idea because it was almost continuous refresher. They could go to the Facebook page, they could get the announcements, or Twitter, they could find out when the classes were going to be. They would get emails throughout the chain, the program. They could be updated very easily with supplemental materials. And of course, when it cost, everything cost out, it was less than the print versions of everything. So it was a great idea. And it, not too many people have done that other than them, but they've found it to be very helpful. And it's something that if you're just in the initial stages of it, you may want to research out. We've even had some programs who, they don't give people phones, but they use phones as part of that curriculum delivery. Obviously, phones are very hard in terms of hard curriculum to develop, but they could use the phones in terms of, and we talk about this in a different section of social media, they use the phones to announce specific things. They might announce quizzes or upcoming schedules or something that will be happening or bringing something to class. So they may use a Twitter or Facebook on phones in conjunction with their curriculum delivery, not the hardcore curriculum, but in terms of job openings, things like that, schedule of events. Another thing that has to do with delivery and training delivery is, and I talked about it already, was trainers. And you certainly want to go out and get experienced trainers who are certified if you need that, who are good and reputable. But I want you to consider, as you go along, to contacting your employers or potential employers, recruiting them as leverage trainers. You want to have in-kind contributions, which means you don't have to vet them in terms of competitive bid or anything. But it's a great idea to the extent that, and there, you'd be amazed at how many potential employers who are into these remediation or health and safety would be happy to participate as a team or a tag team trainer, guest lecturer. And you want to get them bonded to the program for a whole lot of reasons, not only because of their experience. They are on the inside. They have the latest regs. They know what's happening in the industry. And even more important than any of that is they are in contact with your graduates, your participants. So they can get to know the best of the class, and they may be making job offers before the classes are even over. So I would strongly consider, again, this is tied to your labor market assessment. When you're building your Rolodex and your contacts, one question you should always ask when you're into that one-to-one conversation is, and you feel it's the right time, the right person, would you consider doing some guest lecturing? And they might say, I'll do more than that. So you may want to consider that, but I would strongly urge you to consider employers. And, of course, everything I'm saying here, you want to include in your proposal as you're writing it because it's just so important. The last thing I want to talk about, and we keep these to 30 minutes, so I'll be brief on this, but it's what is supported and unsupported in the curriculum and training. And, of course, we all know that it has to be geared towards remediation, health, and safety. The other courses that are basically your student support, things like anger management, financial literacy, all of those things, team building, they are not directly related to environmental workforce development in terms of EPA remediation. And the way EPA is set up, it's been given funds to train people to remediate brownfields. So you should not, with this particular grant, are not able to finance or fund those programs. And we talk about this in an entirely different session about where you could get these. And it's very easy to leverage the financial literacy, the life skills from other sessions. And if you look at one of our programs on retention or student support, you can find out all about that. But let's look at the EPA funding. And I'm going by last year's RFP, and I'm not sure that this will change. Numbers will probably change, but I want to just mention it. Within EPA, this is a program sponsored by OBLR, Office of Brownfields Land Development and Revitalization. Primarily, originally, it was just for brownfields, and any training you did had to be oriented towards cleaning up brownfields. Over the years, the program has been popular. Other program offices have wanted to contribute because of the hard work of the people at EPA in saying, would you like to have some training done in, say, solid waste management or wastewater, or perhaps in pest management or in alternative energy preparation of sites? And many did agree. So what this allowed them to do, to expand a $3 million program into slightly more than that, they were able to give more grants out. But when you look at this RFP, and again, I'll have in the notes exactly the page number on last year's RFP, you'll see this note that these program contributions, they have a little bit of a dark side. Most of the money, $3.3 million last year, was put up by for brownfields type work, oriented training for brownfields. When you look at things like wastewater, the wastewater people put up about 47,000, pest management put up 10,000, alternative energy about 15,000. So the fair question is, from someone in brownfields, do we want our money going to training someone in wastewater or in air programs, which is not even included last year? And the question is obvious. And of course, anyone looking at this from afar who might be auditing their program would say, well, we gave you money for brownfields and brownfields remediation, and what are you doing training people in air programs where you got no money from air programs? So there's a little bit of a sensitivity that you're going to have to be careful at. It's not a big issue. Last year, there were only, I think, one or two cases where people had programs that were not related to brownfields. It was another program, and it was a major emphasis of this entire grant. Well, you've got to be careful. For example, as of now, unless they're in there this year, you would not want to be doing air monitoring unless you could really tie it into a brownfields. You would not want to have an air program, because air is contributing nothing to this. So you might want to look at last year's RFP and glance over that. I'm not saying it'll be exactly the same, and I don't know what those contributions will be. One thing is that if you look at the grantees last year, they seemed to do fine. They didn't seem to have an issue with this, with a few exceptions. Right. So you just want to be cognizant of it. You don't want to go out and be doing something about some energy efficiency program or weatherization when there isn't money for that in this program. And they'll just knock you out of the box. So you would do everything else just right, but you chose the wrong curriculum because you really didn't fully understand how you tie that into brownfields. Now, most of the programs and curriculum relate to brownfields. Health and safety, all of those really relate to brownfields, because you've got to protect yourself in doing remediation. There are many other courses, RRP, many of these other asbestos, certainly HAZWOPR, they all are absolutely necessary, depending on where you live, to apply to brownfields. So it's important, but just keep it in mind as you're going through this. And in this time, we're in a good space now between now and whenever the RFP comes out. You want to start looking at last year's, and you want to see what you're doing and what you haven't done that's going to take a lot of time. In the notes, I'm going to include a section in there that you may want to look at. I call it Things to Do Now, and it'll give you an idea of, have we really done these things? Have you done any public forum or announcements? Have you been to a church to describe what you're planning on doing? And, of course, all these things that are pre-prep are all dependent on if you get the award. So whether you're working with employers, you're working with city government or city council and want to announce your intentions at the city council meeting, it's all based on getting the award. And it's a chicken and egg thing. You really need to do these things to get up in the ratings, to get a high score when they evaluate your grant. But some of these things, you're kind of sticking your neck out. But I would say don't worry about sticking your neck out, because you always put the caveat that if we don't get the award, you know, these are our intentions. And there may be 15 to 17 awards, and we're applying for it. And perhaps if we don't get this year, we'll work with our regional coordinator and try to get one next year. So you want to put that caveat on with their contractors, with city council, with the neighborhood churches, with your potential employers, your trainers, everyone. You want to line them up before you write the grant. Not, okay, I got to write the grant and these are the things I need and it's too late. Because some of these things, establishing your advisory committee, I don't know how many of you have already done that, but you should have, getting those things all online so that you could put them into the grant. So there's a lot of pre-prep work, and we like to emphasize that now, and there's still time to do it, but we like to tell people they really need to start this grant about 6 months early to get to do it at a pace that you need to write a comprehensive proposal. So, well, I'm already past my time, and I do apologize. These series of talks we're having during this session are more talking heads, me, but others of these in our next group of discussions will be having grantees talk about their experiences. But we feel it's pretty important to try to impart this information to people so they can get ready to write grants if they wish to do it. Are there any questions or people who want to contribute anything to what I've said today? Anything that you, if there's grantees out there that I really have missed or want to emphasize to everyone else here? Okay. Well, our next PLC is going to be on December 14th. And then we're going to have a Christmas break. We'll be back in January. Actually, we'll be starting a new set on January 4th. So until then, I'll send out post-session notes, and you'll get them on Friday. And if you have any questions, you could always email them in, and we'll get you some answers. Okay?
Thank you, Mike.
Okay. Well, thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Good day.